loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we have our regular Friday segment called The Week in Review. We take a look at several big stories. First, we'll address the government shutdown. We'll talk about the new Congress and the Democrats' first proposal called PAYGO, or pay-as-you-go, spending. It's a Republican plan. It was adopted yesterday by the Democratic Party leadership and ratified by the Democratic rank and file in the House of Representatives. We'll also talk about U.S. military airstrikes against Syria yesterday, killing 11 civilians, and Brazil's new far-right president's first acts in office attacking indigenous people, the Amazon, and the environment, which, of course, is winning great applause on Wall Street.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, job growth ended 2018 on a powerful note, with the economy adding 312,000 new non-farm jobs in December. Unemployment rose to 3.9% as more people entered the job market, and the labor force participation rate increased to 63.1%, a broader measure of unemployment that includes discouraged workers and those holding part-time jobs for economic reasons, held steady at 7.6%. Is the economy truly booming? What's going on beneath the surface? Next, French police have arrested a leader of the Yellow Vest movement for a second time in a clear sign that the government is following through on its threats to crack down on protests that have shaken France for the past 6 weeks. Eric Drouet, a 33-year-old truck driver, was charged with organizing an undeclared demonstration for planning to meet six colleagues outside of a McDonald's restaurant. He was earlier charged with carrying a wooden club, leading many in the media to speculate that he's being targeted for his political actions. And finally, again this week, we'll look at the worst, most misleading, funniest, and just plain wrong headlines. And in other headlines, newly elected Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib caused controversy last night when she told a crowd, using an expletive, that the new Democratic majority would impeach Donald Trump. While at this point the idea of impeachment has little traction among Democrats, Trump responded with a series of tweets arguing that he would never be impeached because he won, quote, perhaps the greatest election of all time, unquote, and, quote, had the most successful first 2 years of any president ever, unquote. Hundreds of German politicians had personal data and documents leaked in what appears to be a major hacking operation. Germany's National Cyber Defense Agency held an emergency meeting to deal with the development. Newly inaugurated far-right Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro refused to rule out the possibility of the United States opening a military base in the country. Bolsonaro then went on to praise the military for being, quote, the last obstacle to socialism, unquote. Under successive governments led by the left-wing Workers' Party, Brazil pursued a policy of independence from the United States on the basis of Latin American integration, but Bolsonaro has promised a dramatic reorientation. The United States issued a travel warning to its citizens traveling to China, warning that they could be arbitrarily detained by authorities. The warning is widely seen as a reference to possible retaliation for the detention of the CFO of Chinese company Huawei in Canada at the request of the United States. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our regular Friday segment called The Week in Review, where we look at the biggest issues of the week. We talk about the week in politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman. She joins us here in the studio. Jacqueline is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're also joined from Dayton, Ohio by Ted Rawl. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com, and that's RALL.com. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Walter, Jackie, Ted, welcome back.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start again. The government is shut down. Well, not really. Just parts of the government, but 800,000 federal workers are affected. Many others, contractors, are affected. Some people will be paid back when the government comes back. Others have been forced to take furlough. Many private contractors are just basically laid off. Again, that stalemate will continue because Donald Trump insists on the border wall, the so-called absolute need for a $5 billion allocation to build a wall, or now he says a fence or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, that continues. But Ted Rall, we have you for a few minutes in the beginning here. One of the big issues, of course, is that the House has been now taken over by a Democratic Party majority, and there is a band of progressives who have run either as social Democrats or members of the DSA or more liberal wing of the Democratic Party. They're there. And the big question will be, outside of the enhanced diversity, will there be a change in Democratic Party politics? One of the first tests, of course, was the so-called Democratic rules, the rules that they adopted, their own rules. And one of the rules is what's called PAYGO. Talk about what happened.
PAYGO is actually, like so many quote-unquote Democratic ideas, actually an idea that originated within the GOP back in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan, when it was floated that any increase in one section of the federal budget has to be made up for by corresponding cuts in another department or in another program in the same budget. It's something that Democrats resisted for a long time, so it's kind of surprising to see Nancy Pelosi articulate this as a way to hold the Republicans accountable. What the theoretical idea seems to be from Pelosi's standpoint, that if we're going to spend $5 billion on a wasteful border wall that's not going to have much of an effect on anything, then that $5 billion should probably, presumably, one to the likes of people like me, will come out of, say, tax cuts for the wealthy. Historically, there's no evidence that that would happen. Historically, the idea is with the Republican president and the Republican Senate, we could more likely expect that the cuts would come out of social programs that are of benefit to working people. And that's what's always happened in the past at times like this. But what we have right now is a I hate to say it, a Mexican standoff, to use a cliche that's probably been overused in this. And so this is right now, it doesn't look like either side is likely to bend because neither side has any real motivation to. But historically, it's usually the Democrats who do.
Yeah, that's the voice of Ted Rall. I'm looking at a tweet from Ro Khanna, one of the more progressive members of the Democratic Party. Ro Khanna wrote, "This is how absurd PAYGO is. We campaigned in the better deal for $1 trillion in infrastructure spending over 10 years. Under PAYGO, if after 6 years that plan would produce a deficit, it would not be in order. Even in 10 years, it would create 16 million jobs and revenue growth." In other words, if they spend more money, if it creates more jobs, if it improves the infrastructure, can't do it because the Democrats have decided to adopt a Republican rulemaking sketch whereby if you increase funding for anything, including entitlements, meaning money for Social Security, money for Medicaid, money for Medicare, money for the things that people need, if you do that, then you have to take it from another part of the deficit. Now, Jackie Lookman, when the Republicans were ramming through the $1.4 trillion, or maybe it's $3.4 trillion, we really actually don't know the numbers, tax so-called relief, which is basically a tax windfall for the ultra-rich and corporations, they weren't worried. They weren't worried that the money had to come from somewhere, although they'll now use it as an excuse to cut those same entitlements because they say, oh, the government's short. The government doesn't have enough money.
Yeah, I mean, and another instance in which the Republicans and the Democrats didn't bother to ask where the money is coming from is when they approved the nearly $700 billion defense budget. So nobody was concerned about offsetting expenditures when we're throwing money away at the Department of Defense that lost. I think the tally keeps going up. What is it, $17 trillion now? They just lost it. They don't know where it is. This is such a transparent attempt by the establishment Democrats in the House to stop any progressive legislation going forward. They do not want real change for real people. They just want to maintain power. And I think this PAYGO rule is just the most transparent example of that. And I think they're going to pay for it. I think they're going to pay for it in their next election cycles.
Ted Rall, I mean, don't the progressives have enough? All they needed was 16 votes because the Republicans were going to vote against the the rules that the Democrats were proposing. So aren't there 16 liberals? Aren't there 16 actual genuine liberals who would vote no on PAYGO?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, the part of the problem is that with freshman congressmen is, of course, that they're freshman congressmen. They don't have seniority in the House leadership, and the leadership headed by Pelosi can prevent them from advancing to committee memberships and chairmanships that are that they view as important, and they can be effectively locked out the way that Barbara Lee was recently from a post that everybody believes that she had coming to her due to her many years of service. So I think the House leadership is probably going to be able to keep their caucus together. There isn't sort of a new progressive, hardcore new progressive caucus that has emerged that has been seems willing to express any solidarity. And the metric that I think the reason I'm saying this is because looking at the Pelosi leadership battle for the speakership, she really didn't suffer any kind of real opposition whatsoever, even though there was a lot of noise from the new progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. So in the end, she ended up endorsing Pelosi and voting for her, and most of the so-called new liberals did the same.
That was the voice of Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist. We're talking about the new Democratic Party-led House of Representatives, again, adopting basically Republican rules. They could be waived. These rules could be waived if they wanted to. They're actually signaling something. They're signaling that we are the party of austerity. Now, it seems to me to be absolutely absurd. They just won 40 seats. They have a chance to signal what kind of different road they're going to take from Donald Trump. Donald Trump is pretending to be the friend of the American worker. He's saying we're putting tariffs on these other countries' companies because I'm for the American workers. If American corporations suffer as a consequence, good, let them come back and build manufacturing plants here. Let's do things here so that American workers benefit. And American workers obviously have been hollowed out. Their communities have been hollowed out by deindustrialization and offshoring and so-called free trade deals. So here you have the Democrats come in and they have this House of Representatives majority, and they're coming to the 2020 election, and they can signal the same constituency that they must win in order to win. And they're saying, guess what? We're going to put the brakes on. We're not going to go beyond an austerity plan. We're going to adopt the Republican plan. We're not going to be wild extremists. We're not going to have health care for all or Medicare for all. We're not going to do anything that would actually be impossible on the PAYGO ledger. Because if you have to pay for, say, an expensive program like Medicare for all, which would give all people in the United States health care, mm-hmm. affordable health care, if you do that, it's going to cost more money. And they're not going to take it from the Pentagon. So they're going to say, oh, we'll take it from some other much needed program. That to me signals that the Democrats have absolutely no plan to go beyond the Hillary Clinton orientation that lost in 2016. Walter?
Yeah, and you know, they had another opportunity to take a stand for working people against big corporations and Wall Street, and that was 2008, right? It was a historic opportunity to really reorient how things have been going in the economy and in society. They had control over the House of Representatives, the Senate, the presidency. The big banks in Wall Street were unbelievably unpopular right at the beginning of Obama's first term. You know, they had just been bailed out at the very end of the Bush administration, which was highly, highly unpopular, caused outrage across the country. And if they wanted to, they could have done things like break up the big banks, or, you know, well, pass the Employee Free Choice Act, pass a high minimum wage, do all sorts of, you know, progressive programs to sort of readjust the balance of power between ordinary people and Wall Street. But they didn't do that. And now all indicators are that they've moved even, you know, further and further to the right. And so now that they just have the House of Representatives, I don't think we can expect them to do really a single thing to help ordinary people.
Although they could.
Let's put something else out there on the table, too. A lot of what we're talking about now and what we will continue to talk about in the weeks and months ahead are internal House of Representatives rules. Now, the Speaker of the House, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, makes those rules, and the rules change constantly. So what we're complaining about now is something that Nancy Pelosi can change with the stroke of a pen, but she won't, because she's no different than any other person seeking a position of great authority and great power in Washington, D.C. We should not expect Nancy Pelosi to take a progressive position on a lot of these internal questions, because she's not as progressive as she wants people to believe she is.
Yeah. And just to put this in perspective, Ted Rall, if Nancy Pelosi's PAYGO rule had been imposed, say, on FDR, on Franklin Delano Roosevelt, the New Deal would not have happened. We would not have had Social Security. We would not have had unemployment insurance. We would not have had all the things that people consider to be fundamentally essential to their lives, and things that came from a Democratic Party administration. It wasn't a socialist government. It was a Democratic Party, a government, but it was more liberal, certainly far, far, far to the left of Nancy Pelosi or the current crop of Democrats.
I'm glad you brought up FDR, Brian, because this is basically going back 100 years as if John Maynard Keynes had never lived and had never had an influence on the United States. I mean, the United States only became a superpower when it, in the early 20th century, when it imposed a broad-based permanent income tax. And it only became a country with the ability to fund a social safety net after 1933, when it decided to indulge in the same deficit spending that every other modern industrialized nation in the world does and is part and parcel of standard economics. And it's, you kind of have to be on the far right-wing fringes to say that deficits are this huge problem that are going to cripple us, and that we should run the United States the way that you run your home economy, which in fact, parenthetically, no one does, because people borrow money to buy cars and people borrow money to buy houses. And if they didn't, very few people would own houses or cars. So the entire economy is propped up on debt, and the ability to do big things that will hopefully pay off and then generate economic activity, put money in people's pockets, come back in the form of taxes, that's the real trickle-down effect that actually does work historically and does stimulate the economy in a way that tax cuts for big corporations and the ultra-rich never have and never will. And so it's staggeringly bizarre to see the Democratic Party that I grew up being taught was the party of the working man and woman resort to something as retrograde as PAYGO, as if it were 1927 all over again.
That's the voice of Ted Rall. We're talking to Ted Rall, Jacqueline Lookman, and Walter Smolarek in our segment called The Week in Review, talking about what it looks like for the House of Representatives when the Democratic Party has a big majority. Again, only three Democrats, Representatives Ro Khanna from California, Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez from New York, voted against the PAYGO. So that's a clear indication of where the Democrats are going. And at the same time, in one of the big things that happened this week, is you can see that the allegations against Bernie Sanders' campaign are such and are being repeated in a way in the mainstream media and by Democratic Party leadership, like the Democratic Leadership Council or David Brock, that, you know, Bernie Sanders, there's an effort underway, and this isn't to diminish the issue at all of allegations of sexual abuse or misconduct. Sanders said it's a highly decentralized campaign. He was on the road. He didn't know about it. Even there, the CNN sort of, when you look at the sort of tagline at the bottom, it says Sanders was, quote, too busy, close quote, to deal with sexual harassment. It's obvious that there's an effort underway to make it impossible for the genuine liberal wing of the Democratic Party, led by Bernie Sanders, to actually succeed in getting the nomination in 2020. This is all part of a move to sort of solidify what's called the center, but which is really the right, because these are basically Republican programs.
Yeah, this whole letter that came out of nowhere after 2 years after the 2016 campaign, I saw it circulating around on social media. I was really suspicious of it. Not the issue, like you said, Brian, because nobody's diminishing the issue. I mean, campaigns are just these weird kind of fishbowl microcosms of very focused, energized people, a lot of inexperienced people. The vetting is kind of shaky sometimes because you have to get so many people on the ground so fast, you know, doing a lot of work. So, yeah, things will happen and people are people and some people are just kind of crappy. So you're going to miss some things. So I don't doubt that some of these allegations are absolutely true. But what I'm really, really suspicious of is the fact that according to the people who allegedly wrote the letter, they wanted to keep this a private issue between them and Sanders. They wanted to ensure that going into his 2020 campaign, if that's what he's going to do, that he didn't allow the same mistakes to be made in his campaign that were made in 2016, where these things happened and there seemed to have been no oversight in management in those areas. Nothing in this letter implicates Bernie Sanders. Nothing. Absolute. There is no connection to Sanders knowing about this, ignoring it, dismissing it. But it's not being reported that way in the media because the media is already trying to hamstring Sanders' campaign. They're already trying to delegitimize him because he's that much of a threat and they know it.
Yeah, Ted Raw, when we think back about what actually happened in 2016, the Democratic Party establishment led by Hillary Clinton and financed by Hillary Clinton, I mean, she actually owned the DNC. And when the emails came out, which were blamed on Russia, about whatever the source, the Russians say, no, it wasn't us, but whatever the source, they came from WikiLeaks. They revealed that the Democratic Party actually was skewing the primaries such that Hillary Clinton, in spite of her monumental advantages, had even more advantages so that Bernie Sanders couldn't win. I don't think the American ruling class will allow Bernie Sanders, even though he supports empire, he supports U.S. foreign policy. Things have gone so far to the right in terms of domestic politics that Bernie Sanders, who would have been perfectly acceptable in the 60s or in the 30s, is considered a complete outlier now. What do you think, Ted?
I totally agree with that. I also think worth noting in the same vein is the announcement by Elizabeth Warren this week that she's running, almost certainly running for president. She hasn't. It's an exploratory campaign announcement, but usually those don't come with the release of a video or formal statement. It did this time, so I think it's safe to say 95% chance she's going to run. And Elizabeth Warren is, if nothing else, Bernie Sanders' biggest problem. Without her, he really has the progressive wing of the Democratic Party locked up in the primaries. And if he's going up against 5 or 6 or 7 more centrist figures like Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, then they split up the centrist Democrats, and Bernie Sanders becomes the nominee, especially given that he's learned presumably from some of his mistakes in 2016, like not campaigning in the southern states. So I think Elizabeth Warren seems at this point almost like she's trying to get out ahead, and she's getting a lot more establishment support than you would think that she would have. If you think about the kind of figure she was in 2010, 2011, during the Occupy movement, she was positioned as more of a genuine progressive. But after 2016, when she refused to endorse Bernie and endorsed Hillary Clinton instead, and that's something that progressives are not likely to forgive, she's sort of now the officially acceptable progressive to the mainstream media. And as hard of a time as they're giving Bernie Sanders over, as we say, an important issue, but kind of sketchy and somewhat weak tea at this stage, they're giving her a lot more leeway and support and oxygen than you might have expected, given her ideology 7 years ago.
Those are good points. And again, just I want to reiterate, we saw yesterday in the rules vote where the Democratic Party leadership is going. Only 3 Democrats voted no on PAYGO. And so if you have a situation where PAYGO is an indicator that the Democrats are going to stay as sort of Republican light, but not that light, mainly just like the traditional Republican program, not FDR type style liberal Democratic politics. And if you have Bernie Sanders getting, they're trying to knock him out, whether it works or not, who knows. But the other thing is that this, John Kiriakou, this campaign is filling up quickly. I mean, we're two years away. It seems to me reasonable to think that Joe Biden, who would be like the Obama administration without Obama, which of course is a difference, but the policies that Obama represented, which were the Hillary Clinton policies.
Yeah.
Again, Obama administration policies without Obama, I think it looks very likely that's what's about to happen.
I think that's exactly right. Dianne Feinstein yesterday came out just on her own volition and announced that she was endorsing Joe Biden for president. Joe Biden hasn't even said that he's running for president yet.
Does that happen where people endorse candidates who haven't announced?
No, frankly, and it happened the day before when Martin O'Malley, the former governor of Maryland and 2016 Democratic candidate for president, came out and endorsed Beto O'Rourke, who hasn't even... talk to his family yet about whether or not he should run for president. Brian, you and I are old enough to remember when Pierre DuPont ran for president in the Republican primaries in 1984 and announced just after the midterm elections. And people mocked him because it was 2 years until the presidential election, a year before the primaries began. Now it's just a normal thing.
You know, the biggest surprise that we just discussed just now is to me the idea that Joe Biden might actually, after all these years of teasing, actually become a serious candidate for president of the United States.
Isn't that true?
He's the Democratic version of Donald Trump. Donald Trump repeatedly has said many, many times over the years that he was thinking of running for president and never did, really. And then finally did. And could Biden really be about to pull the trigger? He's certainly closer than he's ever been. I don't think he can win the nomination, but it's an interesting thing to see. I mean, if I'm advising progressive, if I'm advising Bernie Sanders, I would tell him, what you need to do is do something that's never been done before. Announce your vice presidential pick in advance. Choose someone like who can balance the ticket, like Kamala Harris, or someone who would be a partner like Elizabeth Warren, and announce that early. And then you follow the Trump model into the primaries. You have 30 or 35% of the Democratic electorate consistently. You let the 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 other centrists split up the remainder of the vote, and they all become like Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, forgotten. And then he coasts to the nomination. Now, whether he can beat Trump or not in the general, that's a bigger challenge. But that would be my advice.
I don't think we're going to be able to have Ted Rall on the show soon because he's going to be actually the campaign manager for Bernie Sanders.
Sounds like it.
Good advice. Anyway, that's all the time we have. We're going to continue after the break in our show, The Week in Review. We're talking to Ted Rall, award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist, Jacqueline Lookman from the Lookman Nation, and Walter Smolarek, Sputnik News analyst. Stay with us.
Loud and clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
This week we talk, as we do every Friday, about the week in the news, politics, policy, and international affairs with Jacqueline Lookman. She joins us here in studio. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We're also joined from Dayton, Ohio, usually it's New York City, by Ted Rall. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com. That's R-A-L-L.com. And we're joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
You know, I saw that the new acting Secretary of Defense, Shanahan, spoke for the first time to his aides yesterday. And he said he was going to focus his work on implementing the new national defense strategy, which they're using these kind of euphemistic bureaucratic language, peer-to-peer conflict. Now, I mean, that's just ridiculous. What they mean is major power conflict with Russia and China. And he said the focus of his work is going to be, he said it's three things, China, China, and China. Yeah, the U.S. is actually preparing for major power conflict in the coming period. No longer counterinsurgency, no longer anti-terrorism, getting ready. Yeah, everybody getting ready for war with Russia and especially China. That makes a lot of sense, Jackie.
I mean, there has been this idea floated around on the QT in defense circles for a very long time. But it was obviously something that the War Hawks couldn't say out loud. But now we have a president who not only manufactures all kinds of crises, but escalates crises for the sole purpose of making America look strong. And that really is what this is from a political perspective. There is really no military tactical reason to go to war with China.
But I want to just interrupt for a second. It seems to me that, yes, Trump is doing just as you said. He's manufacturing political crisis because it's good. But Ted Rall, it seems to me that this is also a consensus position. The Democrats, when I looked at Adam Schiff, who's going to be the House Intelligence Committee chairperson, when I looked at the agenda he's announced, it was partly Russiagate, but it was North Korea and especially China. It seems like a consensus position, not simply, well, Jackie's completely right. Trump does all of this for political grandstanding, but it doesn't seem to me it's just that. Go ahead.
She is right. It is grandstanding. And it's, if you scratch the surface of this, you can sort of understand that even though it's easily saleable to the American public that China is an emerging power and therefore a possible threat, they remember Mao Zedong. They see that China just landed a probe on the dark side of the moon. They're a space power. They now have a bigger, fast-growing navy that is all over the world. That was never the case before. It's saleable. The problem is it's just not actually true. The way that China, if you're really looking to confront China and try to contain it as a regional superpower, you'd have to do it economically. China's been spreading its power not by military force, but by influence, by, for example, financing highways and railroads and dam projects throughout Central Asia and all over the world. In fact, many African countries have Chinese construction projects that are very tempting to the local governments because they're far more favorable to those governments in terms of the deal points that they get than what they used to have to tolerate under the IMF and the World Bank for similar construction projects. So if the United States were really looking to counter Chinese power and influence around the world, what it would be doing is spreading money and building infrastructure for the rest of the world. I mean, it'd be nice to get some here too. But that's not what they're doing. This is pure posturing. It's pure politics. And it does seem to be a consensus position because there's a split in the establishment as to whether what the Democrats' desired new Cold War against Russia is viable. But both the Democrats and the Republicans can agree on China, so that's what they're going with.
Right, and the U.S. did have a strategy for economically encircling and containing China. It was the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, this enormous quote-unquote free trade deal that was negotiated over the course of several years. It was ready to be signed. It would have had, a devastating effect on a lot of working class communities. It would sort of accelerate like the hollowing out of, what little industry exists. It would, give corporations enormous powers to cross borders and to sort of make and break laws as they please. Donald Trump, for his own very demagogic, narrow reasons on the 2016 campaign trail, adopted an anti-TPP position. And so for those very personal reasons, I think this is, indicative of the broader reason why the elite does not like Donald Trump, even though, Donald Trump is not sort of like the true champion of the people as he presents himself. For his own personal reasons, he scrapped the TPP. And so it deprived the Pentagon really of sort of the economic corollary of the military decision to have a quote unquote pivot to Asia.
We're talking with Jacqueline Lookman from the Lookman Nation. We're talking with Ted Rall. He's an award-winning editorial cartoonist. We're talking also with Walter Smolarek, Sputnik news analyst here in the station. John Kiriakou, the acting interim Secretary of Defense, Patrick Shanahan, was the guy who said, we're getting ready for peer-to-peer conflict, also known as war with Russia and China.
It was the first official statement he made.
Yeah. So I want to talk about Patrick Shanahan for a moment, and then I want to introduce the possibility that he will be replaced soon. The rumor is possibly by Jim Webb, and Ted Rall had mentioned the Chinese Navy. Jim Webb used to be the Secretary of the Navy under Ronald Reagan. But here's one thing about Patrick Shanahan. Before he became the chief of the Pentagon, he was a senior executive at the Boeing Corporation. Now, wouldn't it seem to you, John, that the Boeing Corporation would benefit greatly from the preparations for peer-to-peer conflict, also known as war with Russia and China? This guy has no actual military experience at all, but he is is a capitalist Wall Street, a capitalist military defense contractor. That's Patrick Shanahan.
He had no governmental experience. He had no intelligence experience. And he had no foreign policy experience. and now he's the acting Secretary of Defense. But boy, he knows airplanes, doesn't he? This is the thing. You know, we complain about how the past three or four consecutive chairmen of Goldman Sachs ended up as the Secretary of the Treasury. Well, the same thing is happening now at DOD with a former Boeing executive. Now, Jim Webb is being discussed, at least in the New York Times, as a possible nominee for Secretary of Defense. He's an interesting guy. He would be the first Emmy Award winner, for example, to be Secretary of Defense. He's an Emmy-winning former journalist, if you could believe that. He's also the author of 10 books. When he ran for the Senate in Virginia, Republicans tried to use those books against him because his books always have gratuitous softcore pornography in them. It's graphic, even if it's softcore. It didn't work. He still won that Senate seat. He has many, many staff members come forward and complain about what an ogre he is to work for. He's really not a very nice man. But by God, he knows the Defense Department, and he knows the Navy. And he may be the kind of across-the-aisle nominee that Donald Trump needs to make just to keep people quiet.
He's a Democrat.
Or at
correct. Least he well, ran he, as a Democrat.
He pretends to be a Democrat. He's a very conservative Democrat, let's put it that way.
I think his appeal, though, is the fact that he's kind of, now that I thought about it, because I thought, oh, you know, Jim Webb wouldn't accept this position. But then again, I think there might be some logic, if you want to call it that, to his possible selection. He, if I remember correctly, he ran on a campaign of like sort of anti-interventionism. He was not for sending troops all over the country. He was really not for continuing the tradition of America being the policeman of the world. At the same time, he's still very hawkish. He's not anti-imperialist, but he's also not let's have the first response to any conflict be sending troops in. So I think that's the appeal that he has for Trump.
So it would show that Trump picked a Democrat. Politico, in addition to the New York Times, has also written about the possibility of Webb becoming Secretary of Defense. Their first sentence, they describe him as iconoclastic former Democratic senator from Virginia. Penn, Webb, who's 72 years old, wrote an essay right before the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. He warned in that essay, quote, "Those who are pushing for a unilateral war in Iraq know full well that there is no exit strategy if we invade." That, of course, is absolutely true. He said the Iraqis are a multi-ethnic people filled with competing factions who, in many cases, would view a U.S. occupation as infidels invading the cradle of Islam. So he was an opponent of the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
He was.
From a tactical point of view. But, John, you'll remember, and Ted Rawl, I just don't know how old Ted is, but Ted will probably remember.
55.
Ted will definitely remember then that he was the Secretary of Navy during Ronald Reagan's era. And that's when Reagan vowed to, quote, stop the communist winning streak by remilitarizing America. They implemented the Star Wars program, yep, a strategic defense initiative, taking war to outer space, but also projecting a very vast naval increase under Jim Webb, the 600-ship Navy. This was the escalation against the Soviet Union, the full-court press. And in many ways, it worked because it created a crisis of confidence within the Soviet leadership at the time that many Soviet leaders were dying and new ones were coming in. And I think the Soviet people felt, hey, Reagan, Jim Webb, the others are pushing us to the brink. Maybe there could be a war. That created a crisis. Anyway, Ted Rawl, you start, and then John Kiriakou.
Yeah, well, you know, I always think of Jim Webb as sort of the Democrats' John McCain. He's sort of a similar figure in a lot of
That's
ways.
That's a great analogy.
Stylistically. I think we all agree he'd be a great get for Trump. I kind of go with Jackie's first thought, though. I don't see what's in it for Webb, really. When you're so already a conservative Democrat, look, working for Donald Trump has not proven to be a springboard to bigger and better things. You think about figures like Scaramucci and so on. You know, they get they get burned and kicked on the way out. They don't get a graceful exit. They don't get a thank you for their years of service. Presumably, they go on to whatever form of officially sanctioned and legalized corruption they can figure out. But it's not. I think if I were close to him, I would probably say, you want to stay away from Donald Trump. He's not good for anyone. You're not going to come out of this smelling good. He kind of corrupts everything that he touches. So just from a careerist point of view, it's good for him, his name to be in the mix. But I'll be surprised, not shocked, but I'll be surprised if he takes it.
Brian, just for fun to wrap this up, I got to tell you, Jim Webb loves to write in his spare time. It's his hobby. He's quite proud of it. And it's like he's got some kind of a magic touch, because almost everything he writes turns into something. Even in television, he won an Emmy Award for a script that he wrote, became a movie, a Warner Brothers movie called Whiskey River, where a soldier goes to fight in Iraq. He's injured in Iraq. He comes back before he's fully recovered. He's called back into duty. His father doesn't want him to go back into duty, and so his father kidnaps him. In an interview later, Webb said that with so many wars that we're fighting at any given time, it's actually easy to come up with storylines because there are so many different military-related storylines happening in real life.
Ted Rall has to leave us. We want to thank Ted. He joined us from the airport. And Ted, you have 15 seconds left on Jim Webb. You said, don't do it. I think you're right. Michael Flynn, General McMaster, General Kelly, Rex Tillerson, James Mattis, didn't work out well for any of them.
No, it's just not a good move. I mean, if he called me, I would have to say no. You're the president of the United States, but you're a whole lot of trouble.
All right. Now we know Ted Rall is not going to accept any position in the Trump administration. Ted Rall, thank you so much for joining us. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
That was Ted Rall, award-winning cartoonist. You can check out his work at www.rall.com. That's RALL.com. Let's go on to another story. Earlier this week, there was a lot of pushback against Donald Trump for saying he was going to take U.S. troops out of Syria. I have to say, this pushback did not come from the American people. This came from the neocon consensus establishment here in Washington in the military-industrial complex.
And they pushed hard.
And then, of course, even people who are liberals who in the past would have said, bring the troops home, because Donald Trump was the one saying they're going to bring the troops home, they were like, now, oh no, we can't bring the troops home. Well, last night, whether the troops are still there or not, U.S. aircraft are still bombing Syria. And again, that's not legal. Not legal is to put it mildly. It's an imperialist act.
Yeah, there's basically two ways I think that the Pentagon is trying to get around this order to withdraw troops from Syria. And one is by intensifying these airstrikes that end up killing, many, many, many civilians. And the other way, I think, is by, so the troops will leave Syria, but they'll just go to neighboring Iraq, maybe just even a few miles across the border, and sort of prepare to re-intervene in the country at a moment's notice. The Pentagon has also said that, special operations, special operators will continue to conduct missions inside of Syria. So, there's different angles, I think, that people who are, proponents of a U.S. military presence everywhere are working to kind of like soften this decision. But yeah, I mean, what a remarkable response from people who would sort of otherwise or maybe falsely portray themselves as being, progressive people are out here saying, this is a disaster. You're just giving Syria to Russia or Iran like it was, like a colonial possession of the United States.
Yeah, I think Walter's right about what the U.S. and what the U.S. Pentagon is doing. Trump says, we're going to bring the troops home. Then he said, well, I didn't say exactly when they're going to come home. There's no deadline. It doesn't have to be right away. We talked to Ambassador Peter Ford, the former UK ambassador to Syria, yesterday. Ambassador Ford's position is that, no, Donald Trump is actually going to bring the troops home. He doesn't want the troops there. It's not a new position. He's been saying this since 2016. It's a position that resonates with his base and even beyond his base, with people in the United States who are sick and tired of the U.S., endlessly intervening with military force in other countries. But here you have, I think there's going to be a lot of resistance from the Pentagon, even though Mattis, before he left on January 1st, signed the order to begin the withdrawal. That's going to happen. But the bombing signifies, look, we, the U.S. military, are not leaving. We arrogate to ourselves the right to bomb Syria. And I think if the U.S. were to leave completely, it will be perceived in the region that the U.S. lost. The U.S. lost. And can an empire ever really voluntarily acquiesce to the perception of defeat? Because defeat says something. It's like the mafia. If they say they're going to break your legs because you didn't do something, and then they don't break your legs, that sends to other people, they might not break my legs. It feeds the atmosphere of possible defiance to the empire. During the Peloponnesian Wars, John, as a Greek American, you'll know that the Athenian Empire wiped out whole islands because they professed neutrality, because no one could speak against the empire, because neutrality even was dangerous. And we see that with the United States. If you, in those big moments like before the Iraq War, if somebody said, well, I'm not for sanctions on Iraq, or I'm not going to vote with the United States, they were punished. And the U.S. made it clear there would be a price to pay.
In fact, Yemen as a country never recovered from opposing the U.S. Counterattack against Iraq in 1991. Yemen was on the Security Council, voted no along with Cuba. They were the only two countries in the Security Council to do so. And Yemen never recovered as a country.
Yeah, I mean,
destroyed.
I mean, so many people were expelled then from Saudi Arabia. The Yemeni government was severely sanctioned. The U.S., like an empire, has to signify we don't lose. Now, they lost in Vietnam. Because they lost. I mean, they were militarily defeated. And because there were so many people in the United States against the war in Vietnam, they couldn't do the one thing that might have led to a victory, which was to drop atomic bombs or nuclear bombs on Vietnam. But that would have led to a civil war in the United States because of the political opposition. So they lost. There were two fronts, the Vietnamese front and the American front. But the Vietnamese front was this, you know, the military front was the central front. In Syria, the United States has been defeated in its efforts to crush Bashar al-Assad, but they're not on the run. They're not being pushed out. And I think the Pentagon loathes the idea of a perception of defeat under these circumstances.
Before Jackie responds to you, I wanted to tell you that Vice President Pence made a statement in which he said, no, we are withdrawing from Syria. The president said we're going to pull out. We're going to pull out. And the reason we're going to pull out is that ISIS has been conclusively defeated. So he finally has taken a position and is pushing back on those neocons who want a U.S. military presence in Syria.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. But at the same time, you have an official from the Department of Defense or someone from the Department
right.
of Defense tweeting on New Year's Day.
Yes.
You know, the United States is about to drop the ball on New Year's Day. Well, we're prepared to drop something much bigger. You know, so there is this attitude, like you said, Brian, in defense circles of not wanting to appear to be losers in Syria, not wanting to appear to be weak, because that's what for some defense officials, especially career military people, and unfortunately, even some soldiers, that's what pulling out of Syria means. That's what it feels like or looks like to them, that America is appearing to be weak by not, quote unquote, staying in the fight. So while it's okay and acceptable and absolutely it should be done, that troops are being removed from Syria. That's why this bombing campaign has to continue in the minds of military-minded people, because they're still perpetuating this idea that we can beat these people by bombing them into oblivion. And that tweet from just New Year's Day, which has since been, I think, removed, that reflects the true attitude of the commanders in the military and a lot of the military personnel about their role in the world. They really believe that America's strength is a strong, brutal, unrelenting military presence, you know, bombing people into submission.
That's Jackie Lookman. She joins us every Friday here in this segment called The Week in Review. Jackie also joins us every Wednesday where we look at the news in review in the middle of the week. Walter, let's just talk about the bombing yesterday, the specific character of this bombing. You remember, I know, because we had many shows about this. right before the November 2016 election, it appeared that Obama had engineered, along with the Russian government, and in particular John Kerry representing Obama, a ceasefire that looked like it had chances of holding in Syria. This was after Obama had sort of basically given up on the idea that they could overthrow or crush the Assad government, right? So the agreement was signed, and then the next week or days later, the Pentagon bombed fixed positions of the Syrian Arab Army, meaning they weren't going back and forth between Syria's army and ISIS. These were fixed positions. The Pentagon knew exactly who they were bombing. They bombed and killed a whole lot of Syrian Arab Army soldiers. That's the Syrian government soldiers. And the ceasefire was off. And so the Russians said, we don't know who we're negotiating with. Kerry says he wants a deal. And then the Pentagon, which obviously under Ash Carter, they had said, we don't want this deal. They destroyed the deal by bombing it. What about the bombing yesterday? Was it like that?
You know, I don't know if it was of the exact same character, but it, you know, certainly could be, you know, perceived that way by different actors. And that's sort of really the key thing, right? How is that interpreted politically? So I think that the plan B to overthrowing the Syrian government that the Pentagon was for, right? You know, even if they sort of would prefer to install a client regime over the whole country, was the partition of the country, was that basically everything east of the Euphrates River, so basically the northeastern like third of Syria, would become more or less permanently under the control of a loyal militia called the Syrian Democratic Forces, which has as its core component the YPG, which is the People's Protection Units, a Kurdish group. So the withdrawal from Syria makes that project basically untenable, because what was preventing other forces from the conflict going in and, you know, taking back that part of Syria from the Syrian Democratic Forces, YPG, whatever you want to call it, was the presence of, you know, several thousand U.S. troops, which would be sort of like untargetable, right? It would be a disaster if another force were to kill some U.S. troops. And so now the SDF obviously has been preparing for the eventuality of a U.S. troop pullout or the possibility of that, because now they're making an alliance with the Syrian government. Maybe the country will be reunified. But yeah, this secondary project now is even being messed up by the Trump administration of partitioning Syria.
Brazilian assets soar as Bolsonaro starts to deliver on promises. The capital markets, the capitalists are very happy because the new president granted the agriculture ministry the power to create new indigenous reserves, stripping the National Indian Foundation, known as FUNE, of its key function. They're going after the Amazon. They're destroying indigenous Indian lands. And of course, Wall Street and capital is very happy. 30 seconds left.
Capitalists are happy that they are about to make untold amounts of money off of the decimation of indigenous cultures, off of the stripping and raping their land, and also off of denying rights to LGBTQ people and people of color, descendants of slaves in Brazil. Brazil is a nightmare scenario for civil liberties and human rights, but it's exactly what the Trump administration and a lot of neocons
and Wall
are trying to, and Wall Street would love to implement here because the profits are so great.
Amazing. Right-wing, semi-fascist or fascist government. And of course, within hours, the capital markets love it. They love it.
They all think they're going to make money here.
Yeah. And it's about money. They don't care about people's rights. Matter of fact, they want to decimate those rights because it helps them make more money. And when we talk about decimating rights, we're talking about decimating people. That's what's going on. Anyway, we have no more time. That was Jackie Lookman. She is the editor-in-chief of Lookman Nation. You can check out their live stream every week on Facebook and YouTube. We were joined from Dayton, Ohio by Ted Rawl. Ted is an award-winning editorial cartoonist and columnist. You can check out his work at www.rawl.com. And we were joined in studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Walter Smolarek. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.